MacArthur to kick off today's session. Lisa?
Thank you, Jean, and welcome everyone, and good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are in the country. My name is Lisa MacArthur, and I'm a member of EPA Region 10's RCRA Lead Region team, and it's my pleasure to introduce you to the RCRA Expert Brown Bag webinar series. So this series is an effort to capture and share RCRA institutional knowledge and expertise, both within the EPA and with our state and tribal partners. Webinars are offered live on Kluin and recorded for future viewing, as Dean went over. So in this series, RCRA experts are trying to talk about how they know what they know. So speakers will cover what their topic is and why it is important, their keys to success, what are some key pieces of advice and lessons learned, their go-to resources, so tips on the best resources, such as guidance documents and training for the topic area, as well as a case study or example application, giving you one or more real-life examples that help explain the topic's importance and illustrate how they use their keys to success. So it's now my pleasure to introduce Narendra Chowdhury, who is going to give us an overview of EPA's procedures for identifying hazardous waste under RCRA using the listing determination process, and he's also going to walk us through the four different lists for hazardous waste. Narendra is a chemical engineer with EPA's Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. He has 32 years of experience, 6 with our Office of Pesticides and Toxic Substances, and 26 years with our Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. He's widely viewed as a national expert, and it is our delight to have him doing today's webinar. So just one more word, there will be plenty of time for questions at a few points in the presentation, but as Dean said, feel free to type in questions into your Q&A box as we go along. For this presentation, we encourage you to think about broader or process questions rather than asking very specific questions about a particular waste. So with that, I will turn it over to you, Narendra.
Thank you, Lisa. Hello, everyone. I'm going to talk today about making a hazardous waste determination under RCRA using the listing process. I hope that my presentation will give you a better understanding of how EPA makes a decision on whether or not to list a waste as hazardous. To let you know, a majority of our listings were done in the 80s, when the RCRA program was just starting up. Then there was another period between 1990 and 2005 where we did hazardous waste listing determinations for many large industry waste. Since 2005, there have not been any listing determinations involving new waste, but we have amended existing listing and removed a listing. So let's get started. I have divided my presentation into three parts. In part one, I will go over the basics. What is the definition of hazardous waste under the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act? And how does EPA's regulations identify hazardous waste under RCRA? Okay, next slide here. In order to discuss the definition of hazardous waste under RCRA, we have to start with Congress's original statutory definition under RCRA, Section 1004, which defines hazardous waste as a solid waste or combination of solid waste which, because of its quantity, concentration, or physical, chemical, or infectious characteristics, may cause or significantly contribute to an increase in mortality or an increase in serious, irreversible, or incapacitating reversible illness, pose a substantial present or potential hazard to human health or the environment when improperly treated, stored, transported, or disposed of, or otherwise managed. Based on the broad statutory definition of hazardous waste, EPA developed a regulatory program to identify hazardous waste under RCRA. EPA's regulations require that In order for a material to be a hazardous waste, it first must be a solid waste. A solid waste is any discarded material that is not specifically excluded by regulations. Generators are required to make a hazardous waste determination when waste is first generated. EPA's regulations establish two ways of identifying solid waste as hazardous waste under RCRA. First, a waste may be considered hazardous if it exhibits a certain hazardous waste characteristic. This part of hazardous waste identification was covered in the previous webinar presented by Greg Helms and is described briefly on the next slide. Second, a waste may be considered hazardous if it is included on a specific list of wastes EPA has determined are hazardous. And this is the focus of my presentation. To see if a waste is a characteristically hazardous waste, EPA's regulations in 40 CFR 261.21 through 261.24 describe four specific measurable properties of waste. They are ignitability, corrosivity, reactivity, or toxicity, which indicate the wastes are hazardous. To see if a waste is a listed hazardous waste, our regulation 40 CFR 261.31 through 261.33 contain four different lists of hazardous waste that describe, meaning provide a narrative description of waste from various industrial processes, waste from specific sectors of industry, or waste in the form of specific chemical formulations that EPA has determined to be hazardous. These four lists are the F list, which are hazardous waste from non-specific sources. This list contains hazardous waste generated by various industries or types of facilities such as wastewater treatment sludges from electroplating operations. Hazardous waste code F006. These wastes are listed under 40 CFR 261.31. The K list, hazardous waste from specific sources. This list contains hazardous waste generated by specific industries such as spent pot liners from primary aluminum production. Hazardous waste code KO88. These wastes are listed under 40 CFR 261.32. Then there are the P list and the U list. Both of these lists contain commercial chemical products that become hazardous waste when they are discarded or intended to be discarded. The difference is that the chemicals on the P list are identified as acute hazardous waste, and those on the U list are identified as toxic hazardous waste. Some chemicals on both lists may also be designated to have other properties. These wastes are listed under 40 CFR 261.33. In part two, I want to explain EPA's hazardous waste listing determination process. What are EPA's regulatory criteria for determining whether or not to list a solid waste as a hazardous waste under RCRA? What are the steps in EPA's hazardous waste listing determination process? EPA developed a set of criteria for listing hazardous waste. EPA's regulations in 40 CFR 261.11 state we shall list only if a waste exhibits a characteristic, which we discussed earlier. Those are ignitability, corrosivity, reactivity, or toxicity. A waste has been found to be fatal to humans in low doses. or it meets either LD50 or LC50 criteria as acutely hazardous. Or C, the waste is capable of posing a substantial present or potential hazard to human health or the environment when improperly treated, stored, transported, or disposed of, or otherwise managed. We generally use the criteria in Section 261.11A3 as described in C above for hazardous waste listing determination. Section 261.11A3 specifies that EPA consider 11 factors when making a hazardous waste listing determination. That's on slide 11. Seven of the 11 factors deal primarily with waste characteristics. They are constituent toxicity, concentration, waste quantity, migration potential, persistence, degradation product potential, and bioaccumulation potential. Four of the 11 factors are individual factors. They are plausible management, damage cases, coverage by other regulatory programs, and other factors as may be appropriate. We consider a combination of the above factors to make a listing determination. The next few slides will provide an overview of the steps in EPA's hazardous waste listing determination process. The process consists of three general steps: data collection, risk assessment, and regulatory or rule development. The data collection step includes the following: an industry study. EPA starts by gathering readily available information on the industry. For example, number of facilities, location of facilities, production processes used, products manufactured, waste generated, quantity of waste generated, and waste management practices. Industry questionnaire. EPA has authority under Section 3007 of RCRA to collect additional data to fully characterize the industry and waste in question. Section 3007 questionnaires provide facility-specific profiles of production processes, waste generation, and waste management. Site visits and sampling and analysis. EPA conducts site visits to gather information on waste generating processes and identify potential record sampling locations. Sampling and analysis provides data for waste used in the listing determination. Following data collection, the next step is to use the data to perform a risk assessment. The risk assessment approach for listing has greatly evolved over the years. The current approach uses multi-pathway modeling to assess risk from waste management scenarios. This approach considers potential risks to human health and the environment resulting from releases of toxic constituents in waste to air, surface water, soil, and groundwater. Selection of waste management practices to model. The selection of waste management practices is a key because exposure to constituents in waste, and therefore the risks involved, will vary by waste management practice. EPA's basic approach for selecting waste management practices in listing determination is to examine current management practices and assess whether or not other practices are available and would reasonably be expected to be used. Evaluation of modeling results. The modeling predicts concentration of toxic constituents in waste following their release and movement through the environment to a potential human or environmental receptor. EPA typically considers the decision to list a waste when carcinogenic risks from constituents of concern in the waste are 1 times 10 to the minus 5 or greater, meaning 1 in 100,000 or greater, or when the non-cancer hazard quotient is 1 or greater. And this is a ratio of basically the concentration of the constituent over some health standard. If it's 1 or greater, then EPA will normally decide to go with a listing. Peer review of risk assessment. In 1994, EPA established a policy to have scientific and technical products, including risk assessments, peer reviewed to ensure regulations are based on sound science. Once a waste evaluation is complete, EPA starts developing a proposed rule. The proposed listing determination decisions and supporting documents undergo internal EPA review and OMB review. The supporting documentation for the proposed rule are assembled and placed in the public docket so that useful public comments can be prepared by interested parties for submission to EPA. EPA publishes proposed listing determination decisions in the Federal Register and requests public comment. There's usually a 60-day to a 90-day public comment period for proposed rules. After close of the comment period, preparation for a final rule begins. All public comments have to be reviewed and addressed. A response to comment document containing all public comments and EPA's responses is prepared. The final listing determination decision and supporting documents undergo internal EPA review and OMB review. The supporting documentation for the final rule are assembled and placed in the public docket. And EPA publishes the final rule in the Federal Register.
Narendra?
Yeah.
This is Lisa MacArthur, and you have just a few questions at this point.
Sure.
Someone is wondering, what generally drives the start of the listing process? Is it a request from industry, or concerns on EPA's part, or something else?
Normally, I mean, we did majority of the listings in the 1980s, and that was driven by the passage of RCRA. Then in 1984, we had the HESWA amendment, and they established deadlines for completing a number of listing determinations. The agency did not meet those deadlines, and then we were sued by the Environmental Defense Fund in 1989. To enforce the statutory deadlines for listing decisions. And in 1991, EDF and EPA entered into a consent decree, which was amended several times to revise the deadlines for EPA action. So we were sued to get a lot of the listings finished between that period, 1990 to 2005. Those are all like things included in HESWA, which we needed to complete, and we were pushed by the Environmental Defense Fund to get them done. And a lot of times, Yeah, either some environmental group sues us to get it done. Sometimes we get a petition from industry to do something, or some environmental group. So sometimes when we see that, yeah, there's some issue with certain waste from certain industry, then we start collecting data on our own and try to, do that. But until very recently, these are becoming very complex rulemaking and require a lot of resources. So we haven't been able to do too many, and many of the large industries have already been looked at.
Got it. Thank you. And this is a little bit of a related question, but someone asked, if a manufacturing process changed over time, kind of what's the process for updating the narrative in the list? Would that be something where industry would ask you to make a change?
Yeah, there are a couple of processes. We have a delisting process where an industry, if the process changes over time and they're not using the chemical that the waste was originally listed for, then they can submit a delisting petition under 260.20, 260.22, and provide supporting information showing that, you know, their list, their waste does not meet the listing description and or doesn't contain the constituents of concern at the levels that we originally looked at. And then we go through basically a rulemaking process to get the waste from that specific facility delisted. So it would be just their waste that would be delisted. Another way of doing it is if there's a lot of facilities who have changed their processes and now it's very different from what we originally listed, we may amend the listing by collecting data from all these different facilities and show that, you know, it doesn't meet the listing description or doesn't contain the toxic constituents that we originally listed for. So that is also another rulemaking process, going through proposed and final rule, and we can amend the listing for basically a whole group of facilities.
Great, thank you. And a final question, and then we'll continue on. Someone asked, what is LD50 or LC50?
Oh, sure. It's the lethal dose. 50% of animals die at that concentration. Mm-hmm. And lethal concentration is the LC50, which is also it's the concentration where 50% of the animals die.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, so in part three, I want to briefly go over how have hazardous waste listing determinations evolved over the years. How does a hazardous waste listing get amended or removed from a hazardous waste list? First listings for hazardous waste were promulgated in 1980, as I stated before. And at that time, EPA's principal focus was on the identity of the waste constituents, concentrations of constituents, and the toxicity of constituents. EPA was likely to list waste containing significant concentrations of toxic constituents unless the waste constituents were incapable of migrating in significant concentration, even if improperly managed, or that the waste constituents were not mobile or persistent should they migrate. So a lot of those listings in 1980, they were based on just having highly toxic constituents and information about their toxicity. And a lot of the PNU waste were listed at that point. And those lists came from a lot of different sources. They were like list of canceled pesticides, DOT classified poisons, toxicity priority pollutants under the Clean Water Act, human carcinogens or potential human carcinogens by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC. So between early 1980s and early 1990s, EPA continued to list waste with significant concentration of toxic constituents using simple risk assessment methodology. EPA typically only considered risk arising from release of toxic constituents in the waste to groundwater and subsequent human exposure. So we had very simple models, and you know, basically the key thing was how toxic the constituents were that were in the waste. And it was listed mainly on that, and if those constituents could migrate. So use maybe physical chemical data, not much modeling, and the only modeling we had was something that would show the movement to like a groundwater well. Little specific modeling was done to assess the release and transport of toxic constituent in the groundwater for waste in question, but often relied on analysis performed for other things or other rules. Risk was estimated based on a ratio of the concentration of a toxic constituent to the health-based benchmark. And that's similar to what we were talking about, like the hazards quotient of one or greater. It's like you're taking the ratio of what you find at the receptor, the concentration of the toxic constituent, over what the health-based standard may be for that constituent. If it's greater than one, then you would list. The carbon waste listing in 1995, and this is one of the first listings under that EDF consent decree with the EPA, was the start of a more comprehensive evaluation for making listing determinations. EPA surveyed all U.S. carbon waste production facilities and analyzed current waste management practices. Used a multi-pathway risk assessment to evaluate risk from various waste management practices. The listing determinations for waste are based on risk from existing and plausible waste management practices. So EPA was sued on that listing determination, and that was the carbon waste court decision. The dithiocarbamate task force, which represented the manufacturers versus EPA, the court vacated a number of listings for carbamate waste. And the main concern raised by the court's decision for EPA was on its selection of plausible mismanagement scenario in making listing determinations. One case where the court decided to vacate a listing involved the decision on the K-160 listing, which is for solid thiocarbamate waste. This involved a single manufacturer who shipped its waste to a line landfill. An EPA modeled risk from disposal of the waste in an unlined landfill and argued that unlined landfills had been used in the past and could be used in the future if waste was not listed. The court rejected disposal of waste in an unlined landfill as plausible mismanagement scenario because the manufacturer was sending the waste to a lined landfill. The most recent listing decisions for new waste and they were also part of the EDF consent decree with EPA, were the paint production waste and the dyes and pigment waste listing determination. And you can see these were more than 10 years ago. So we haven't done any new waste listings since that time. In general, EPA has moved to relying more on evaluating risk from existing waste management practices and less on projecting practices not in use. And that came out of that Carbon Waste Court decision in 1996. The more recent listing decisions for waste are also contingent on disposing of the waste in a specified management practice. So we have been evaluating and making it contingent on the waste going to a specific type of a disposal scenario. So recent decisions to amend or remove listed waste. So as we discussed during the question and answer period, EPA's regulations provide a form of relief for listed waste through a site-specific process known as delisting. Under this process, any person may petition EPA to remove its waste from regulation under the list of hazardous waste. EPA had granted delisting to a number of motor vehicle manufacturing facilities that generate FO19 waste using the zinc phosphating process. So FO19 is a wastewater treatment sludge from the chemical conversion coating of aluminum. There were a number of motor vehicle manufacturers who were using this zinc phosphating process that didn't have the type of constituents that FO19 was originally listed for, and we had been issuing a number of delistings for those type of waste because they were not hazardous. So, like I mentioned before, it's a very time-consuming and resource-intensive process, even when you're doing a delisting, because, you know, it involves a rulemaking process where petitioner has to submit waste data and we have to evaluate it, do a risk assessment, and, you know, go through proposal and final rulemaking. So that takes up resources from industry, resources for EPA to do those individually. So the industry asked us to do an amendment to that listing, which is this amendment to FO19 listing that was done in 2008. EPA amended the FO19 listing to exempt wastewater treatment sludges from zinc phosphating when such phosphating is used in the motor vehicle manufacturing process, provided that the waste are not placed outside on the land prior to shipment to a landfill for disposal, and the waste are placed in landfill units that are subject to or meet the specified landfill design criteria. So it was removed based on the waste going to a particular type of a line landfill. Otherwise, it would still be listed. In 2010, we actually removed a listing after a long time. And this was the removal of saccharin and its salts from the U list. The Calorie Control Council submitted a petition to EPA to remove saccharin and its salts from EPA's hazardous waste list and other hazardous lists. The Calorie Control Council argued in its petition that the current scientific evidence, as viewed by key public health agencies such as the National Toxicology Program and the International Agency for Research on Cancer, does not support classifying saccharin as a potential human carcinogen, which was EPA's original and only basis for placing saccharin and salt on its hazardous list. EPA evaluated the petition, considered the original basis for the listing, NTP and IARC's more recent conclusions about the risk of carcinogenicity of saccharin and salt, as well as other criteria required for making a listing determination. Based on this evaluation, EPA determined that saccharin and salt do not present a significant risk to human health or the environment, and therefore EPA removed it from its list. So the next couple of slides, basically I list some of the general hazardous waste listing resources. Basically all the listings are in our Code of Federal Regulations, which can also be obtained online in the Electronic Code of Federal Regulations. And another good source is EPA website, and you go under defining hazardous waste page, including box on key resources, where we also have put together a user-friendly listing reference document, which basically tries to put all of the information that we've generated over the years since 1980 to pretty recently. I think the latest draft or this document is 2012, and it basically had all of the letters, memos, Federal Register notice sites, and things like that in that reference document. And then you can also go to regulations.gov one of the key things as far as if you want to understand how the determination was made and you need more information than what the proposed or final rule provides, there's always a background document, especially for the F and K listed ways that are available. And you go to this website, regulations.gov, and on this website, enter the identification numbers that I have provided, and they give you the background document as far as what is the supporting information for that listing determination. And on the last page is basically some of the key early Federal Register notices for these FK, P, and U listings. So I guess if there are any other questions, I can take them now.
Thank you very much, Narendra. And we do have some good questions stacked up here. Okay. One person is wondering, is there a difference in process for listing the F waste and the K waste?
I don't think there is any difference. I mean, you still have to go through the same process of looking at the facility, generating the waste, what's in the waste, knowing information about waste constituents and the levels of constituents and doing a risk assessment based on where the waste is disposed or how it's managed. So as far as, doing a determination which would be like the one we normally do that involves looking at all of those things, it would be pretty much the same.
Okay, great, thank you. And then someone else asks, how long does it take to actually complete the delisting process?
I guess it varies. Sometimes, you know, it can be done. I mean, not one thing, the delisting program we delegated to the regions about 20 years back, so the regions do the delisting. But when we used to do them here, it could vary from year to more than a couple of years, depending on how complicated the situation was. Sometimes we had to go through several rounds of trying to get the data from the facility because they need to submit a petition with supporting information. If they don't have the right type of representative sampling data for the waste or what we need, then we have to go back, they have to collect the data. So it depends if a facility submits the complete petition the first time or not. And many times that was not the case, and it would take longer. If you have a complete petition, maybe you can put a proposal out pretty quickly in 6 months or so and maybe finish within a year. But some of them took several years.
Great, thank you. And we have a little bit of a meta question. Someone wants to know where they can find the list of delisted waste. And they're wondering if this list is updated periodically.
Yeah, I think Appendix 9 in under 261, 40 CFR 261, is where all the delisted waste are usually placed. So 261 point, yeah, Part 261, Appendix 9, 40 CFR, Part 261, Appendix 9.
Great, thank you. And someone is wondering if the new definition of solid waste will have any impacts on the listings we've discussed today, the new DSW rule.
I am not that familiar with that, and I don't know if it will or not.
So no problem. We can write back to that person after the webinar.
Yeah.
And then folks are asking a lot of questions about specific materials, which we're probably not going to get into now. But I will ask you in general, are there plans for listing any new waste?
Yeah, we're always looking to see if, you know, we need to look at any other industries or things like that. So, I mean, one of the ones, you know, we're looking at maybe, you know, the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, there are always new drugs coming out and things like that. But like I said, anytime you do a large industry, it requires a lot of resources and at one time when we were working on this EDF consent decree where we had to do like a dozen or more big industries and look at all their waste, we had more than like maybe 15 or 20 people just doing the rule writing, and there were a lot of other risk assessors and people like that. And right now in my branch, I'm the only listing person left. Most of them are retired or gone. And we don't have a lot of resources to do that kind of a large effort. And a lot of times, then the only way it gets done is, you know, when somebody petitions or we get sued or something like that, because we have so much other work going on that it's hard to put that many resources in a large effort because those require a lot of data collection. And, you know, the risk assessments have become much more complex now. Industry has become much more sophisticated in responding and, you know, providing comments, and then you have to respond to all those comments. They do their own risk assessments sometimes and provide you, you know, that, no, what you did is wrong and, you know, you should do this. So you have to redo that whole thing. So this, it's just much more complicated and complex than when some of the original listings were done.
Great. Well, thank. Well, that makes this webinar with you extra special if you're the last listing guy. The next question is that you mentioned some newer listings for paint production waste, and people are wondering where they could find those. Where can they find information on the paint production waste?
We did a listing determination for paint production waste because this was one of the ones on that list of the EDF consent decree. A determination was made not to list the waste because these wastes were either already being handled as hazardous or they were going to a certain type of landfill. So the final decision was not to list paint production waste. So you would not find it on our list. But there's a, I guess probably can go to regulations.gov or something where you can find the proposed and final rules, or also on our EPA website under hazardous waste and listing. There probably is going to be something on that where you can look at the proposed and final decisions.
Okay, great. Thank you. And we'll end with a question here that's a little bit of a thinking outside the box question. It says, the whole concept of process-based hazardous waste and how they are listed or delisted seems outdated. Has EPA thought about moving to a system that relies on how a material is managed to determine if it presents a risk and must be regulated?
I don't quite understand, because we do look at how the wastes are managed. We have changed, based on that carbon waste decision, to see if, if the wastes are being managed properly. And a lot of the, before there were a lot of online landfills, and now most of or all of the landfills are lined. A lot of the wastes are managed in line landfills, so we take that into consideration. So one of the key things is anybody being exposed to these materials, if they're managed properly? If not, then we usually make a determination not to list, or we make a conditional or a contingent management type of listing determination where we say that, okay, if you're taking your waste to a line landfill or something that, is being managed properly, then we normally would not list because people are not being exposed to it.
Great. So you're already taking that into account.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I think that evolution has come about because we have to now consider more and more exactly what the industry is doing and not rely on what used to happen in the past, because before there were a lot of landfills which are online, and you're going and having releases to groundwater and things like that, which maybe don't occur in certain other type of management scenarios which are more safer.
All right, well, Narendra, that was our last question. So I just want to say thank you very much for your time and your presentation. And we'll certainly send you, I know people have asked about a number of sort of individual types of waste, and we'll get those questions to you later.
Thank you.
So I want to just tell folks, please do join us next time on August 3rd from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Jim O'Leary from EPA headquarters will be talking about the art of rulemaking. And notice that we're skipping the July webinar due to the holiday, but again, I do hope you'll join us in August. And again, attendance for this webinar is open to EPA and our state and tribal partners, so please do feel free to share the registration link with state and tribal partners. And at this point, I will turn it back over to you, Jean.
All right, excellent. Thank you so very much, Lisa. Let me walk through just a few final reminders before we close out today's webinar. As noted, copies of the presentation materials that were discussed today, as well as a number of the links, have been made available as part of the seminar links or resources area. If you follow the hyperlinks that appear under related URLs, there's one that's called Seminar Resources. If you click on that and simply press the Browse To button, that website will open up where you can download a copy of the slides and browse through some of the web resources that were discussed by today's instructor. I've also included that as a message to everyone today in the Q&A window in the lower right corner. There's contact information for today's presenter as well as others in the series that you'll find on the seminar homepage, so you can refer back to that if you have outstanding comments or questions that you need to follow up with. And I do ask if each of you could take a moment to fill out the online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery. We had over 415 individuals join us from all over the country for today's live broadcast. So we will ask if you could take just a moment and let us know what you thought of today's event. If you happen to share the line with multiple parties, each person can fill out their own feedback form. And if you're one of the lucky individuals replaying the recorded or archived version of today's webinar, all of the links that I've discussed are still accessible. You can still download the slides, you can look up contact information, and also provide feedback for replaying the webinar following the links as noted. So with that, I'll just remind everybody that we do often get requests for CEUs or PDHs. We don't necessarily issue those credits for our webinars. However, many participants are able to document and earn credit for participating simply by saving their registration emails, copies of the materials, and then filling out the online form. When you fill out that feedback form, there's a box you can check to request a confirmation email. As long as your email address is entered correctly and you check that box, we'll send you a confirmation message that verifies you submitted feedback after the live delivery. And usually that combination of materials is enough to document your online participation to earn credit. So I thank those of you who joined us for today's broadcast, all of our organizers and instructors who joined us today, and hope that you all found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. The recorded version of today's webinar should be available in just a week or so, and you'll all receive an automatic email once that's available. So thank you all so very much for joining us. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.